The ASCL Leaders Reading Podcast with Jeff Barton.
I'm Anne Longfield and I'm the Executive Chair of the Centre for Young Lives.
And just tell us, Anne, before we talk about your book, which is coming out shortly, Young Lives, Big Ambitions, just tell us about the Centre for Young Lives, what it does.
Well, the Centre for Young Lives, I'm really proud of it. We launched at the beginning of February this year, so we really are in our kind of early years and early days. We are a think tank, essentially, which is dedicated 100% to children, young people and families, but also an innovation unit. We really felt that there was a policy gap here. We have think tanks around the economy, we have think tanks around health, we all think that's quite normal, but we don't have that kind of precision and focus on children and young people. And given the range of issues that we know children and young people are facing and experiencing, in some cases battling today, we felt there needed to be that focus. So it is early years, but we are a strong, small team, and we've been working together for a number of years now, so we've got really great support and lots of potential collaborations. So we're very grateful for that and very ambitious for what we think we can achieve.
And prior to that, you were Children's Commissioner, including through the pandemic, you were Children's Commissioner. And previously, you worked on, for example, Sure Start schemes.
That's right. Well, I mean, essentially what you're seeing is that from that is that, you know, children, young people and their families have been what I focused my whole career on. I ran a national charity for 20 years, which not only raised policy issues and looked at solutions, but also put forward, actually ran services, especially around children's centres and Sure Start. It was something that at the turn of the century we felt was really a missing gap in the infrastructure of our country. And we put forward those policies. I was seconded into the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit under Prime Minister Blair, working on that for a period of time, and then went back to the charity to deliver some of those. So, you know, dismantling all of that was, in my view, still one of the greatest historical mistakes over recent years. And having a kind of infrastructure that supports children and families is something that we really believe is as much needed now as ever. I became Children's Commissioner in 2015. It's a six-year stint. And it was one that, you know, I relished. It was a huge honour. A very broad canvas in terms of children's lives. But I really wanted to take that opportunity to focus on what the evidence tells us about the scale and nature of vulnerability. So we set up a framework of vulnerability that could really start to identify how many children were living lives that were more risky than they could be, and then put forward from every bit of the kind of system what needed to change to do that. I used to go along to, you know, government departments in the early days, and I would often be told that the ministers really concerned about vulnerability and vulnerable children. I say, well, you know, what are they thinking of? Who are they meaning? And, you know, you'd go to health and they'd said, well, you know, the children that have ill health and likely to be patients. You go to education, they talk about pupils. Go to Ministry of Justice, sadly, they would talk about kids in custody. You know, wherever you went, departments defined vulnerability through the lens of their responsibilities. And of course, as we all know, if you've got the root cause of vulnerability, it's going to come out in many different ways. And until you tackle the root causes, you're not really going to get to the place we all know those children's lives could be.
Well, that sense of urgency comes through in your book. I've had the privilege of reading it before it's officially published on the 18th of April, but we're going to just talk it through because it seems to me it does a number of things. First of all, it tells some pretty bleak stories of some individual children and some families, and that could make it a pretty bleak read overall, but actually the striking thing is the way that what you're able to do is to bring solutions around that, partly from what you have worked on yourself, partly, I was struck, for example, just reminding myself of what you saw in, I think it was Sweden, when you saw the state really taking seriously the need to look after children and young people, and in a way that's fed into what Labour did with Sure Start, I suppose.
That's right. I mean, I hope I've never shied away from drawing attention to, yes, bleak, but also the lived experience that some children, and let's remember we're talking about children here, are having to grow up with. We know that, you know, a third of children are growing up in poverty at the moment. New statistics with us only a couple of weeks ago, about almost a quarter of them in destitution. It's almost that we start to become used to hearing those kind of statistics and terms, and almost think that that's kind of normal. Again, you know, we know at the moment that a fifth of children aren't in school as often as we'd like. It's an attendance crisis. Your own statistics about a forgotten third of children who are leaving school without, you know, good levels of qualification, in some cases even basic levels of qualifications. You know, those are things which should all send shock through our bodies. But of course, we get used to them. You know, how many times have we seen one in five children now have a probable mental health condition? That should appall us all. If it was our own children in that situation, which of course, sadly, it is for a lot of these families, we would be appalled. But we kind of get used to it and stuck in this notion that we can't do anything about it. But if you look at some of the brilliant things that are happening on the ground, we can see how people do amazing things, often despite the system they're working within. And if we look a little bit broader to other countries, we see countries that have made real, determined high-level pledges to put children first. And, you know, you only need to look at the Nordic countries, you look at what New Zealand have done at different times for different issues elsewhere, and you'll see what happens when you make a high-level political decision to put children first in your country. And often when you'll go to a Scandinavian country, you know, they'll meet you and talk about the country, and they'll define themselves by the way they treat children. We haven't taken that leap here, and it shows. But travelling to other countries such as Sweden, as you mentioned there, and looking at what they're doing at different stages of children's lives to prevent harm but also build well-being, it's not perfect, but nonetheless the political intention is clear.
And I think one of the things that struck me about the book is the way you kind of hold a mirror up to the way things are in this country and say, why on earth are we accepting this? So, for example, you talk about alternative provision, which for lots of young people, not all, but for lots of young people, is never a revolving door back into mainstream. It is a place where they are kind of almost forgotten there. And what you're saying is, it simply can't be good enough that we are abandoning some young people who then are unlikely to be able to get the qualifications they need.
Well, so many of the conversations that I've held over recent years and going back the decades too, they're about barriers that they've just not foreseen and just can't get over. And families where they've been struck by the fact that the system, first of all, a shock that the system isn't set up to work for them. I mean, it's a classic number of responses from parents when they've gone, you know, they found that awful moment when they found a burner phone or they found, you know, a large amount of money in their children's bedrooms, and they ring social services or the police and say, this has happened. I think, you know, this may be around exploitation. So I'm ready. Tell me what to do. And they kind of get, well, that's not what we do. You know, we don't do that. Sorry. And the phone call ends. And I think that, you know, as individuals, we imagine that our systems, which we rely on and trust largely, are there to help us when difficulties arise. And so often when it gets to those difficult times, parents and children find that's not the case. And one of the things throughout the research for this book, but also going back, has been around talking about the kind of education system that can support all children to succeed. And part of that is providing that specialist support for children when it's needed, and not just moving that child to a different place, which isn't either established or designed or funded in a way that can really give them that input and also return them to mainstream schooling. Inclusive education is something that, you know, we have really looked into in some depth. We believe lots more schools actually are delivering elements of, or would like to be delivering elements of this. But as ever, you've got a regulatory system which measures what it sees as important. And, you know, children are stuck in a place where they struggle in mainstream school. We know that there are behaviour issues, and some of the experiences of teachers are dreadful. However, there are situations which I believe can be resolved and prevented. And when you look at some of the fantastic interventions in some schools where there's additional support for children who are struggling and at risk of exclusion or suspension, very high success rates, 95%, 97% success rates of keeping those children in school, largely through positive mentoring, building positive relationships, youth work, and that time outside the mainstream classroom to offer that additional nurturing support. So that really, to me, falls very much into the area of, this is the kind of system we could have if we chose and if there was political will to do so, but it's not going to happen in its own accord anytime soon.
And is that a sign where that is happening, that you've essentially got courageous leaders who say, I know the accountability measures essentially say, for my school to do well, another school has to do badly. That's that kind of is the way it works. And they defy that and say, actually, the reason I came as part of a mission in education is because I want all children from all backgrounds to be able to succeed, and we will therefore find the resources to try and do everything we can. Is that essentially what you have seen?
Well, I think, yes, I think that where you have got that level of commitment and backing, you do have that bravery of those leaders who do, just as you said, we are here for all children. We know that's the right thing to do, and we will do it, and we will be able to justify it when we get to the point of being assessed, despite what the system kind of demands of that. But I think, you know, there are also many more that maybe do elements of this or would wish to do provide more inclusive support, who aren't able to do it or don't feel able to do it because they don't have that leeway, if you like, to stick their necks out in that way. And many others who won't because they think they're being punished for it. The amount of school leaders that said to me, you know, we know that if we do this, we'll be punished because it's not what the system dictates. So I think there is something here very much at the heart of this, which of course is about that political will. But beyond that too, I'm very clear, and I know you are too, is that, you know, schools can't do this alone.
No.
This isn't about schools being the people who pick up everything that other agencies haven't been able to deal with. We know that you know, teachers are the ones that see children every day. You know, they're the ones who will notice when things aren't going right. They're the ones who will see the problems firsthand, whether that's hunger, whether that's wider poverty, whether that's, you know, difficulties and potentially abuse at home. But so often look around for help, and that, you know, that the threshold for other services there is now just so high that schools are almost being left to pick up the pieces, almost, you know, provide that sticking plaster that teachers and school staff will do, because of course they absolutely dedicated to the children walking through the door. But those are, it's almost an impossible task without that level of backup from other services. So for me, always the resolution to all of this is to have a better system of support that actually helps prevent, but is there to support school staff and teachers through.
One of the themes in your book, and you describe having worked on it in this country, but also having seen it in some of those Nordic countries, is an area that government always finds difficult to step into, which is what do we do for those very early years of children, and how do we work with families without patronising them, lecturing them and all of that. And, you know, I'm going on to do stuff around oracy, and I was talking to David Blunkett, who got in touch this week, and what he was saying is that the whole point of Sure Start was not that you were kind of standing on the moral high ground lecturing parents about what they should do, but there was a kind of solidarity between parents where they were learning actively about, in my case, how you talk to your child, how you read to your child,
etc. Yeah, completely that. Nothing will, you know, put parents more off more than the, you know, the implication that they've been judged or, you know, seen as being bad parents. No one wants to be told that, no matter what's happening. And the whole idea of, as you say, of Sure Start is that, you know, you've got people alongside you. And a universal door. And that's just so important that, you know, you're not just targeting those parents where things have gone wrong. Because everyone, obviously, when things aren't going right, you might need help. But, you know, it's not the strongest starting point. So it's very easy to identify children at the very earliest moments in life who have, you know, a very vulnerable family background or would need some support. And so much of that, of course, is related to disadvantage and poverty. And from that point, those families can have people who are working alongside them, building strong relationships and trusted relationships and people that they feel are there for them, you know, and sticking it out for the long term. So it's not just a, you know, it's not just a 6 or 8 weeks piece of intervention that has a beginning and end. It's not just a constant assessment and referral. These are people that you can have in your lives and can work alongside you. And at the end of the day, as parents, we all need a bit of help sometime. It's just that some people need more help more often. And what, you know, what might start as a discussion about, you know, maybe a problem with sleeping or a problem with, you know, relationships between siblings or something like that, can often then develop into, well, our housing's not great, or actually I've got a partner who's violent, or, you know, the root causes again of what we're talking about here. And it's only through those trusted relationships you can get to that point. So it is adding that fabric into communities. And I guess at one point you might have thought, well, if you realistic, you know, you have this idea that families may have been part of that, you know, fabric of community. And I believe they still are. But also practically, we move around much more. We live in places of the country where our families aren't. We might even live in a different country to our families. We work much more. So there just aren't those networks that are as, you know, sustainable over time as near on hand. And I think as a, you know, a modern country, this is what we, what people would not only want, but to some extent expect. It's what we're all yearning for.
Well, I was at the Conservative Party conference the year before last, and Rachel Wolfe, who wrote the last Conservative Manifesto, was on a panel with me, and she kind of leaned across and she said, your job is to make education matter more than potholes, because in the mind of the public, it doesn't. Now, I think your rallying cry in this book is that as a country, we need to make sure that the lives of children and young people matter more than they appear to too many people at the moment. That's essentially what's at the heart of your book, isn't it?
It is. I mean, potholes, sadly, always come out very high. And, you know, potholes are annoying. But, you know, a government can change things. It sounds ridiculously trite to suggest anything other, but it can change the face of the country for the better and achieve real change. Look what happened with child poverty in the past. But we need to make it a priority to get to that point. And my experience as being children's commissioner was too often children, even when they just about edge onto a priority list, you think they're going to get through, but actually there's some other game game in town comes along and they get knocked off. There's always something else which has seemingly a stronger, more urgent lobbying core, a much more of a priority for individuals within government. And look, children and young people they're 20% of our population, but they're 100% of our future. And we should all care deeply, if nothing else but that, about what happens to them. We've got a generation at the moment that have been knocked sideways by what's happened over the last 5 years, from the pandemic onwards. And they need to be given the help and support to be able to stand on their feet and progress in their life successfully. But we should also take what happened 5 years ago as a wake-up call for the perilous state of our system of support around children. It wasn't found adequate during an emergency. And that should make us reflect not only on what needs to change for an emergency, but also what needs to change to make us the confident, successful society that we all want it to be.
And Longfield, your book is Young Lives, Big Ambitions, Transforming Life Chances for Vulnerable Children and Teens. All the best when it comes out on the 18th of April. It's a compelling, powerful manifesto for children and young people. And thanks so much for talking to me about it.
Thanks, Jeff.
The Askell Leaders Reading Podcast with Jeff Barton.